This is Theory of Change. I'm Matthew Sheffield. How do you impeach a president? As a legal matter, it's actually very simple. But as a political matter, it's anything but. Impeaching and removing a president has never been done before in American history. Even impeachment trials themselves are extremely rare in the history of the Republic. Only two presidents, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, have been impeached, while Richard Nixon resigned before the House and Senate took action against him. That means it's historically very significant that House Democrats have decided to begin the impeachment process against President Donald Trump. In the short term, however, it's unclear what might happen. As my guest in this episode, Lee Mierenghoff of the Marist Poll, discusses, there's a real wild card: public opinion. As he found out in his latest Marist survey, Americans are growing more supportive of the House's impeachment investigation, but they also seem to prefer that Trump's fate be decided at the ballot box in 2020, rather than in the Senate through impeachment. That could change, of course, if different facts come out about what the administration did with Ukraine. One thing adding to the uncertainty in all of this is how impeachment, whatever form it takes, might affect the 2020 Democratic nominee. With all the focus that Trump receives normally in the news cycle, just imagine how much more he'll receive if he's being impeached. And that could cause a problem for Democrats in the general election, as most of them are not nearly as famous as President Trump. There's also no telling how President Trump supporters may respond to impeachment. After all, there were a number of reports earlier this year suggested that Trump was interested in having Democrats impeach him for Russia. Ukraine is another matter, of course. And then there's also what the vanishingly small number of true political independents, who do still exist, what are they going to think of impeachment? When you combine all this together, it's possible that the net effect could be zero, at least electorally. We live in a hyperspeed news cycle, and leaders of both parties have vowed to move impeachment quickly. So who knows what might happen? One person who might is Lee Mierenghoff.
He is the longtime head of the Marist College polling operation, which does polls for a number of different organizations, including NPR and PBS. And that is what we're going to be talking about today, his most recent survey. So thanks for being with me today, Lee.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
All right, well, so focus of the poll that you guys just came out with is about impeachment in a political context. And you guys ran a lot of interesting angles on that. But the overall broader number is there appears to be somewhat of a shift in favor, at least in this poll, toward impeachment on the part of the public.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, first of all, you know, there's what I like to call the triple threat going on right now, to use a football term. But, you know, there's three levels of information that we're collecting. One is the information on whether people support the inquiry into the impeachment, which is what's going on right now, whether people support impeachment itself, which would be the House vote to formally charge the president. And then it would go, of course, to the Senate. And then there's the attitudes towards, you know, whether he would be removed or not. So there's actually three different aspects. And what's interesting about public opinion on this is that, you know, as far as the inquiry, we see a fairly noteworthy change from before September 24th, which is when Nancy Pelosi, of course, announces that she's going to, you know, formally move into the inquiry phase in the House, to current public opinion. And in fact, people were really opposed. It was only 41% in most, or low 40s in most of the polls before September 24th. The numbers now are over 50 in almost every poll in terms of whether they think this inquiry right now into impeachment is warranted. And then what I find, and I don't know how deep you want me to go into the data, but you know, I'll take your lead on that. But I think what's interesting is on the other two aspects, the formal charge of impeachment, the vote in the House and a vote in the Senate to remove, those numbers are also in the high 40s, which suggests that there's a group of people who are sort of, you know, against the president, regardless of the level. I mean, the numbers are 2 or 3 points different, but they're fairly similar. And there's a group of people the president has in his corner. And to have a debate on this and then to have a, you know, a so-called trial in the Senate, people aren't waiting around to find out the information as much as they're rooting for their side, and they've already locked in. We saw some changes among independents in this last poll. They're the group that's not locked in, but as far as mostly Democrats and Republicans, you know, they've already, you know, sort of picked sides, and so it's more of a rooting than, you know, for their side than trying to, you know, get to the bottom of what may or may not have occurred.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're definitely right to draw a distinction between impeachment and removal, because it does seem like the respondents are drawing that distinction as well, at least some of them. But let's
And also, Matt, you know, impeachment sort of means sort of the same thing to everybody too. So impeachment, people aren't drawing those distinctions necessarily. It's, you know, sort of like, do you impeach? And then people have to be told that, well, that's not really removal. That's just, you know, the charge. And this isn't even at that point yet. So.
Yeah. Well, and so the top line number, though, now is in the latest one is 52% approve of the inquiry. And that is a slight increase from 49% in your September.
Yeah, when you take prior to, a couple of weeks ago, it was a net plus 3 points, and now it's a net plus 9 points. So if you take the approve and going up and the disapprove going down, there's been a movement of 6 points in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And mostly by independents.
Yeah, and that's a 19-point shift.
And that's what's creating it. There is a little movement, and, you know, we've always been looking at this with Donald Trump. You know, where's his base, and is it showing any signs of cracking? And, you know, there have been different polls along different times that showed a little of it, and you know, we're seeing in some polls and ours, you know, some evidence of that among white evangelicals, among some former Trump's supporters from 2016. But, you know, the Republican base remains largely intact, and I think we're not at the point by any stretch of the imagination where his numbers are going to start plummeting within the Republican Party that will make Republican senators suddenly say, gee, I got to get off this because I could go down with a ship. We're not that by, you know, at that point by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. And then there's also an issue with the idea of removal. That it does not receive as much support as impeachment does. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
I think there's a realistic factor here. Yes. So the numbers fall down on the question of removal from office. And realistically, you're talking about, 53 Republican senators, and you need 2/3 to convict in the Senate. And so there's probably, you're probably talking close to 20 senators. I think that's the number that would actually have to bolt with the president and on this. So I think realistically, there's, the likelihood of him actually being removed from office is very remote. And I think people sort of get a sense of that. I mean, that seems like a tall lift, heavy lift in all these numbers. But having said that, in the prior impeachments, certainly in recent history, where Nixon was and where Bill Clinton was in terms of, obviously there are different levels in terms of how far this reached. But in both of those events, they were presidents in their second term. What's interesting about Donald Trump, this is a first-term president, which means, assuming he runs for re-election, which, he's given every indication of, and assuming nothing has happened by way of removal, during this campaign, depending on the timing of when the House does, let's say, formally charge him, you could have a incumbent president running for re-election with an impeachment hanging over his head. there's not going to be a lot of other oxygen in the room for political dialogue in those circumstances. Mitch McConnell says if it gets to him, he's going to dispense with this very quickly, because I don't think they want to be dealing with that during much of the campaign. But it's terrain we have never traversed before. A potentially impeached president facing a trial in the Senate while running for re-election, there is no precedent for that. So we just don't know how that's going to play out.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, you guys also asked your poll respondents if his fate should be decided at the ballot box or through impeachment.
I thought that was, this process that we're talking about now be, how things get resolved or the ballot box. I think it's interesting that on the one hand, there are numbers very positive for what Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are doing in terms of people thinking this is very serious, that if the president did what is being alleged he did with having a foreign digging up dirt on a potential opponent, how much people find that to be unacceptable also. So in a sense, she and the Democrats have cover in that there's a sense that Trump has done something wrong, that's unacceptable, and it's very serious. Having said that, they're not convinced that this whole impeachment process, although they clearly are at least mixed on it, but they're not convinced that this is going to be the way to go, and that perhaps the better way is to do this through the ballot box and have it be an electoral determination. I think there's a concern, realistically, that people are not loving all the conflict and what D.C. has become and the government, and I think that's some of the frustration that brought Trump into the Oval Office, and it's probably the same kind of frustration that could, in theory, remove him from presidency. But people want to do that electorally. I think they feel they have more control over it. They don't have a lot of confidence in our institutions. There's not a lot of trust there, unlike in, let's say, the Nixon period, where there was not only a more bipartisan feeling, but there's also greater trust in our institutions. Now you don't have bipartisanship. You have incredible polarization, and you also don't have trust in these processes. The bottom line on that is, so people seem to be more comfortable having this be resolved at the ballot box, even though only about half the people think that elections are fair right now. So there's just a lot of concern everywhere you turn on this, but there's still some convincing to do. At least that question indicates there's still some convincing to do on the part of the Democrats to justify the legitimacy of what they're doing going forward.
Yeah. Well, and just for those who haven't seen the survey, there are 48% of people who say that Trump should not be removed, and 48% say he should be, whereas 58% of respondents say that he should be either... His fate should be decided at the ballot box.
Only 37%. Against only 37 who are saying the impeachment process. So there's a 21-point gap between let's have the electoral process resolve this, let's not do it through the Congress. And so that's a very significant point, and one that Trump's side will, I assume, come to start talking about, that the Democrats, which they already talked about a little bit, they're trying to reverse the 2016 election. And, the election becomes something that seems to be the credentializer for who occupies office. Of course, and this doesn't get said, but if Donald Trump happened to be impeached and removed from office, Pence is now the vice president, becomes president. It's not like a reversal of the election. Pence now becomes president. He's the vice president. So it's not like all of a sudden Hillary Clinton now becomes president. That's not where we're going on this. Part of it is, banging the drum and sort of revving up your base. But the reality is, if Donald Trump is not president for whatever reason, Pence will be.
Yeah, and there are some people who would rather have Trump than have Pence.
Oh.
You have to figure it out. Now, there was another interesting little nugget in the crosstabs as I was going through them. You guys and many other pollsters have long asked about presidential reelection, whether people plan to vote for the president or not. And it's interesting that as things have gotten a bit more heated between Trump and the Democrats in Congress, it seems that his numbers have inched up a little bit in terms of people saying they would definitely vote for him. And that's interesting in the context that there was some reporting before this whole Ukraine stuff sort of blew up that Trump actually wanted to be impeached for Russia scandal.
I don't think he'd be tweeting quite as much as he is if that were really the case. But there's certainly an argument to be made that this will and it has already. I mean, you know, we're not talking much at all about the Democrat candidates except for Joe Biden, who has obviously been brought into this part of the discussion. But in terms of their issues in healthcare and the environment and all the things that they were talking about during this debate so far, well, that's kind of gone by the wayside. Impeachment is now the discussion point. And so in some ways, that may be a better political terrain for Donald Trump to fight on. The taxes, the tariffs, what's going on with the Kurds, and healthcare and gun control and all these issues that may be a more difficult lift for him. But let me come back to you because you do raise an interesting point on this question, and I did want to talk a little bit more about that. So we asked people whether they're definitely going to vote for Donald Trump for re-election, definitely vote against him. And the number right now is 39% say they definitely will, and 52% say they definitely won't. And that 52 jumps out, and you say, wow, there's a majority of people who say right now they will definitely not vote for the president. Stick a fork in him. He's done. The reality is close to 54% didn't vote for him last time, and he won. So in a sense, you know, when you take his number, which was in around 46, well, there was votes for Hillary Clinton, there were votes for some minor party candidates, and that's about the number of people who, similar proportion of people who didn't vote for him. And so he sort of has the same size group opposing him as when he started, even though that 52 looks like a really stark number to go into a re-election campaign where a majority of people say they definitely won't vote for you. I mean, that doesn't mean they're all going to be like that, 6 months or a year from now, but it seems like an incredibly uphill fight for him. And obviously he needs to, distribute his support very carefully in different states as they were able to in 2016, winning the whole thing by about 80,000 votes. Nonetheless, this is the landscape. He's got his base. He talks about his base. He feeds his base. He's not reaching out. And that's the strategy he's running on. And right now, the countries are dividing pretty much along that fault line.
Yeah. Well, and it's what it appears to be his strategy. It has a lot in common with past Republican presidential strategists.
Yeah, I remember 2004 was the Bush reelection campaign was all about the base.
Yeah, and the other thing also, though, is that, and you mentioned policy matters as are not being as salient now in the public discourse. And that is an advantage for Trump because his policies, generally speaking, are not polling very well. Like when you ask people about what he wanted to do with health care, you ask him about his tax cuts.
This is not where he wants. I mean, if you go back to what he said he would do in, so-called build a wall and Mexico will pay for it. And other things along those lines, drain the swamp and, stop corruption. And, well, this is not the Middle East. That will be easy to solve. I mean, this is not what's happened. So if you're going to fight issue by issue and promise by promise, this is not the war the White House wants to fight. They want to, just keep going with the people who are frustrated and will look to Donald Trump in two ways. Be an answer on women's issues, because there's a lot of support right to life, and that sense that when the Supreme Court vacancies occur, that will be where he will prove valuable to the more conservative support he has, and so that's a big deal. And then there's the other people who feel very frustrated culturally that they don't feel a part of the process, It's a more rural vote. It's a white vote. It's very often people who don't have a college education. That's, you know, a lot about what he is. And, you know, the splits, the gaps are getting wider and wider. So the red is getting redder and the blue is getting bluer, and there's very little overlap. You had seven people in the 1970s in the House on the Judiciary Committee who voted to impeach Richard Nixon. You will not get seven votes. You may not get any votes in the House Judiciary Committee if it comes to a vote to impeach Donald Trump. I mean, it's just a very different party. And the parties have changed, and they're much more polarized and homogeneous now than they were. And that makes for greater polarization, and that's what we're seeing. So you know, yes, there's something to be said for the Trump side not welcoming this, because I don't think it's a positive, but it's certainly, if you think that Donald Trump thrives when there's distractions going on, and certainly that's been his forte, changing the daily dialogue. This is an opportunity for that.
Yeah. Well, and you look at the generic ballot question. I thought that was another thing that was interesting on this. And you guys hadn't run that question since November of last year.
Yeah. And the generic question, of course, is, you know, are you going to vote for a Democratic in your congressional district or Republican? Sort of a measurement of kind of like which party has got the upper hand. Mm-hmm. And in 2018, the Democrats were pushing between, you know, 6% and 10% on that. I think the number ended up 7%, and that was enough to have a major impact in the House. Now the number is a 3%. So this is there's not a lot of enthusiasm out there. It's more for some of the candidates than it is for the institution. And so people are not looking to Congress or any existing institutions really with any kind of sense of trust, confidence, or enthusiasm. It's a difficult time in terms of, you know, the media, the Trump administration, the Congress. You know, these are not, this is not, notice I left out public opinion pollsters in that, but certainly that would also be part of the group who is not necessarily seen as being, you know, accurate or real or unbiased in any of this.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I think is interesting also is that when you look at there seems to be a bit of a bifurcation in public opinion right now, at least in your polls, about whether Democratic presidential candidates should be talking about impeachment. And that was interesting because in the previous debate that they had, Trump wasn't mentioned.
Yeah, it hasn't come up.
At all.
It's sort of like, as I say, the 800-pound gorilla. I found that surprising. I was teaching a class here at Marist, and the whole class was watching the debate, the last one. And at the end, they said, what was missing from here? And finally, one of the students said, they didn't talk about the impeachment. And I said, yeah. And I just think that will not be the case now. I mean, I think in the next debate, you will see that. I mean, it would almost look like they were intentionally avoiding it if it doesn't come up. And I know Joe Biden has recently climbed on board. You know, in some ways, I think Elizabeth Warren was advantaged by how soon and how early she did come out and what that did for her money. But if you look at what the Democrats alone, where they line up on these issues, 85% of Democrats think there should be this inquiry. 87% of Democrats, similar group, think that the House should vote to impeach, and 85% of Democrats think there should be, the Senate should vote to remove President Trump. There should be a conviction. So you're talking about, you know, 8.5 out of 10 Democrats. Well, if you're Joe Biden, how can you say anything else, given that you're also being attacked as part of this process? How can you say anything else other than this warrants impeachment? This is where the Democrats are. Now, does this deflect attention from where they've been talking about in terms of different plans for health care and what this does to that dynamic? Oh, I think it really does. I mean, I think there's a place for impeachment discussion and there's a place for issue discussion. And I think right now the impeachment discussion is going to take up that oxygen in the room. And I think that is, we're going to see that in this week's coming debate.
You know, and there's a risk there for the candidates, especially the ones that are not, you know, that are much further back in the polls, that the more people talk about Trump, the very little amount of time that they get is going to be spent talking about Trump.
If it's 10 or 11 or 12 people in the debate, I mean, at some point this has got to narrow down so people hear what they wanted from the people that they're mostly supportive of. I mean, if you take the support for Bernie Sanders and the support for Elizabeth Warren, you're over 50% right now. If you want to throw in Bernie Sanders, you're getting to be about 2/3 of the Democrats just supporting those three people. Not a lot of support elsewhere in the room. Let me say one other thing, though, who's going to perhaps get hurt by this, and that is Pete Buttigieg and you know the Mayor Pete from Indiana, in that he had found himself a very interesting place and a niche, if you will, in public opinion. This argument of Medicare for all is not a issue that you can bring to the American people as a whole successfully. Medicare for all is supported as long as you say, as long as there's a choice, or you don't have to give up your private insurance. So when Buttigieg is doing his campaign messaging, he's talking about Medicare for all if you want it. And that's a big difference than what Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi, who are saying Medicare for all, period. And I think Buttigieg was starting to get some traction on that issue. He still may. You know, the Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary are still a long ways off in terms of political campaigning. But I think right now he was starting to get some attention for this very more moderate definition of where he wants to be on health care, in contrast where Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden are. Bernie Sanders are, I should say, the pure Medicare for all period. And so this movement towards discussing impeachment, well, that doesn't give him any built-in advantage. I mean, he'll say whatever his position is. But Joe Biden is getting a lot of attention, and although people think it may hurt him, it isn't yet if it does. In other words, he needed to forcefully respond. It was a little slow in happening, but I think he has made it very clear right now when he did come out for impeachment. It might have been a little slow to the dance, a little late, but it's okay given most of the people aren't watching this as closely as you and me and others like us are.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point to make, because a lot of people who work in politics or media or follow it very closely have a tendency to think that events of a given day or week are immediately going to have an impact on public opinion, and that's just not the case.
No, and what's more interesting is in the current climate, as we were talking about earlier, people are not necessarily information or fact-driven. So even if things are being paid attention, you're watching Fox TV or you're watching MSNBC and it's being filtered in a certain direction to where your predispositions may already be. You're not getting conflicting information in this so-called echo chamber. So you do end up with not adjusting and learning as much as I said before, you're rooting. So the information is, these daily developments are just filling in the details. It's not going to, Stephen Colbert is not going to suddenly start talking positively about Donald Trump because he learned something differently. It's just not going to happen. And I think people are, who, let's say, watch that, they've already lined up. I mean, it's not, and if you've watched Fox News, you're taken care of. You've already picked your side. And that's where the polarization that we are living in currently, this really speaks to all that.
Yeah. Although I do think that cable news is not nearly as popular as it's often perceived as. I mean, like on a given night, only 2 million people or a little over 2 million people or 3 million, depending on the show, are watching.
It's fascinating to me. It has been for some time that what you're saying is true, and yet it seems to drive the discussions. And Trump's tweets Most of even Trump backers don't say they find out about him through his tweeting. But yet it sort of, you know, plays around and kicks around and bounces off the walls a few times. And, you know, lo and behold, it does become what the discussion is. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it's an outsized impact given the size of the audience, but it still seems to drive the discussion so much. And so, you know, and people aren't following at least the impeachment stuff closely. Although it was interesting in this poll, as opposed to 2 weeks earlier, the number of people who were following it very closely fell off by about 7 points. So I'm not so sure how much appetite people have for this, you know, back and forth, and, you know, whether it's just right now it may be serious, but it could be increasingly seen as, you know, just political ploys and maneuvering, at which point the cynicism people have about the process when it takes over could happen.
Yeah. Well, and actually on that point, and it's, you guys didn't ask about it in this survey, but I would be interested in seeing, because one of the points of conflict between the White House and the House has been that Pelosi has not had an actual formal vote to open the impeachment inquiry. And that's the centerpiece of a letter that was recently sent by the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, saying that because there is no formal process, we don't have to cooperate. And so it'd be interesting to see where the public, you know, what they think, whether it should be just a investigations without a formal vote to begin them. Because, of course, by the Constitution, it's not required, but does the public think that's a good idea? I suspect that that may be something that Trump has in his corner there.
Going to take the same, you know, a certain position. Trump is going to say he's cooperating and be happy to cooperate as long as. The Democrats, Nancy Pelosi on her side, are going to say, we're just trying to get to the bottom of the story. You know, what are the facts? You know, we're going to follow the facts where they take us, and we need this information. Clearly, both are having an eye to 2020, and this is a political battle. It's not really about, you know, finding out the information as much as it is what will this have and what impact this will have on the dialogue. And surprise, surprise, politicians are acting politically. You know, so that's where we got it. And so the president has made that case. And, you know, what's interesting, he initially started his defense by taking the position of, yes, I did that, so what difference does it make? And he sort of backed off that because I suspect some of his advising was that, you know, you got to watch the legalities of that. So now there's been a little muddying of the waters on that. And I noticed that Vice President Pence was sort of backpedaling for the president on that. And some of the, you know, on some of these issues, well, he was, when it came to China, he was just joking about that. You know, if you look at the tape, he wasn't joking. I mean, it's like, you know, I tell a lot of jokes. You can usually tell there's a smile and there's a laugh. He wasn't joking. He was sort of just grandstanding, and that's his style. His base doesn't care about that. I mean, they like that. And, you know, his staff are nervous when he goes off script and sort of moves into the realm of things that might not be totally legal. And then they worry about that part of it. And so that's where they have to sort of work around it and then, you know, massage their position a little bit. And that's what's been happening. But again, that's the level that you and I are talking and following. And this is not necessarily, the level that the public is connected to.
Yeah.
Understandably. I mean, you know, there's a lot of other things on people's lives than, you know, worrying about, you know, the envoy of the United States to the Ukraine or to Europe and what Rudy Giuliani's aide, you know, these guys working with Rudy, what they were doing or not doing. I mean, it's all like sort of like intriguing and nutty stuff, but I don't know how much people, you know, connect with it.
Yeah. Well, and it certainly doesn't help things that all the Ukrainian people seem to have last names that sound almost exactly the same.
Of course. So these, the Russian names too. And Although I must say that the whole thing with Rudy Giuliani, having been watched him in New York as mayor for all those years, and having watched him in the prosecutor's office before that, I mean, New Yorkers have a long history with Rudy Giuliani, and this is kind of like an odd place for him to sort of be in the twilight of his career. Somebody said, who worked with him when he was the prosecutor, that the Rudy Giuliani of then, when he was a prosecutor, would prosecute the Rudy Giuliani today. And I thought that was very interesting. I mean, it's hard to wrap my hands around what Rudy Giuliani thinks he's gaining or not gaining from this, other than he has clients and he's making money and all those kinds of things. But is this where he wants his political career to for the sun to go down eventually? And I think that's, surprising for people who've watched him a long time. Seems like an odd place for him to be.
Yeah. Well, it at least keeps him in the spotlight, which has been
one. It does that, and there's no doubt that, he covets that just as the president does. And, I think that, he ran for president. I mean, I think there's no doubt he has that kind of ambition. That's obviously no longer going to happen for him given his age. But, he's certainly, a guy who's still, people want to interview and they've got his view on him because he has the president's ear, and that gets him that point of credibility and access. And that's a lot of what attracts the media to interviewing him. I'm just finding it, now he's in a little bit of a political pickle and it may be a legal problem, and it's just some would say he probably should have known better than some of this stuff. Depending on how it plays out. I mean, I was nurtured during Watergate, and, and during Watergate, we used to say it's always the tip of the iceberg. Something would happen, and then it would rot. You'd peel the onion skins back, and there'd be six other things. And that's this whole thing with Ukraine, and then Rudy gets brought into it, and Pompeo gets brought into it, and then Rudy's having lunch with two guys who are about to leave the country. And, it gets messier and messier. I mean, it's a cops and robbers show after a while.
Yeah. Well, and it's the other thing I think, looking at Watergate for that comparison, is that, if you look at the reportage of the Washington Post and New York Times from that time, it seems like they were a lot more careful about their stories. And Woodward and Bernstein, to my recollection, had only one story that they had to retract, whereas with Trump, there's been I've lost count of how many stories there have been that were not proven to be correct.
And it's, I think that the one thing Woodward and Bernstein, gave birth to, as is this whole generation or two, maybe more than that now, of, reporting as an investigative process. Investigations are funny because sometimes you can be misled. Sometimes, the conclusions aren't as warranted, and someone was talking to me just the other day about, is there a bias in the news one way or the other, and the position was taken, if the bias exists in the media, it's because people really would like to make a story a splash. And so it's not necessarily a liberal or conservative bias as much as it's, I want to be part of the action. I want to, and so I think what you're alluding to is that, whereas in, the Woodward and Bernstein Watergate days, there was a slow building of the case. This thing is flying. And when you move quickly, sometimes, truth takes a back seat. And so I think there are going to be mistakes, and I think we have seen some. And when you're going against Donald Trump, I mean, that magnifies it because that's what he's saying. For him, a kangaroo court's all about, and that's what Rick News is and all that. So if you make a mistake, you're feeding his case by a factor of two than if you don't. So I think a lot of reporting has gone in that direction. Although the preponderance of it is, trying to get information from administration, which I find amazing, the number of leaks that are coming. I think Donald Trump is beside himself with just the level of information that comes out about who was on what phone call and you know, what was said and, you know, who spoke to whom and what happened. I mean, it just seems that, you know, if there's only two or three people in the room and one of them is Donald Trump, somebody's doing the leaking. And there's, you know, if it's not him, it's one of the other two. You know, it's a process that I find interesting just from an outsider to how the process of journalism is, can be both people setting you up, but also lots of information just flying around the White House. I can see where Donald Trump really starts talking to fewer and fewer people and his family mostly, because those are where he finds trust. I mean, that's not the first president who has found trust to be the and loyalty to be the most important values. Because I think as a president, you see a lot of things buzzing around you, and if you can really depend on someone to be on your team and stay on your team, that's something that counts even more than someone who might be really smart or, you know, has good answers to things. I mean, you really want that loyalty, because it ultimately is probably a pretty lonely job, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, that is something that past presidents have said, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of Lyndon Johnson, thinking of Richard Nixon, you know, Bill Clinton during the impeachment. I mean, a lot of people have gone through rough times in the Oval Office, and, you know, they pull the wagons, they pull that circle in closer, because they just don't, you know, it's one way of reacting to it. By the end of the Johnson years in the 60s during Vietnam, I mean, he was not really reaching out. He didn't have multiple sources of information. It just became narrower and narrower, and that's a danger. And, you know, if Trump goes down that road, you know, that's a problem for him, because he does need that grounding, even if he doesn't like it. In other words, he doesn't want to hear what the FBI and CIA briefings are, because he doesn't trust that. But he needs to hear it, whether he doesn't like what they're telling him or not.
Yeah. Well, and on that point, you know, one of the things that he had asked the Ukrainian president about was whether the servers that had been hacked by of the Democratic National Committee were actually in Ukraine. But that is literally a internet conspiracy theory for which there is no evidence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, and not to beat up on the president unreasonably, but, I mean, you know, the places he gets information and the places sometimes he repeats and retweets things are very questionable, to say the least. And, you know, he doesn't draw that distinction, and it puts him in the middle of this sort of unreality. Which is funny, because, you know, what was that, you know, he was sort of in reality TV, and that wasn't real. But now he's in the real part of the world. This is politics, it is real, but he's talking about the unreal part. So I don't know, it's sort of, life has gotten too complicated.
Yeah. Well, now, one of the other questions that you guys asked toward the end of the survey ballot was, if your representative in Congress votes to impeach Trump, would this make you more likely or less likely or make no difference? And it was interesting that the biggest number was saying it would have no difference, 43%.
They're locked in.
Yeah.
In other words, I think that's, you know, I mean, people know right now they're Democratic, they're Republican, they're anti-Trump, they're pro-Trump, and, you know, that they sort of have, you know, I mean, he's such an unusual president, whether you like him or dislike him, it's very unusual, and sort of like, people don't know whether this is the new normal or this is just, you know, an aberration. But when it comes to Congress, I mean, you know, Congress, people don't love Congress. I mean, the numbers for Pelosi and Mitch McConnell are not great, and the numbers for both the House and the Senate are not great. That's not a new story. I mean, that's been going on for quite some time. But when it comes to Congress, it doesn't make much difference, because I know where I'm going to be on Election Day and what levers I'm pulling.
Yeah.
And I think that's what that question gets at.
Well, the partisan breakdown was interesting on that question as well, though, because 42% of Democrats said it would make them more likely. That was, but 50% said no difference. Whereas if you look at Republicans, the overwhelming majority of them, 67%, said it would make them less likely. And then for independents, the biggest number by far was it would have no difference. So it does suggest that there may be some possible room there among independents, because that's a lot of people saying unsure.
And then the group only who's going to be, you know, if both bases are lined up and you know, have, you know, already the cement is as dried and hardened, the only group left to play, you can play for turnout or you can play for wooing and winning over independents. And so that's, but right now that's not where people are going to be. That's going to show up later in the day. We know, and also getting away from the party labels for a while, I mean, there's a geopolitical side to this, and we know that the cities, suburban and rural, have also been changing. And, you know, Donald Trump's, you know, red is a more rural, and the more suburban is where the Democrats took over the House last time. And the Republicans have to do better in those suburban votes, or they start playing with a, you know, lots of acres, but not enough people. And I think that that's, you know, something they have to worry about.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing on turnout, and I don't see it discussed very often, is, so there is the idea of motivating your own side, but there, the other idea is to demotivate the other side.
You've definitely been watching this ping pong match for quite some time. Yeah. So you make you know, their opponent seem so distasteful. And look, last time in 2016, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were both very unliked. I mean, it was the first time that anybody could recall that we had two candidates, neither of whom was popular by a large stretch of the imagination. But then in the last week or so, if you dislike both of them, you end up, you know, going for Trump rather than Clinton. And that sort of made the difference in those close places. So, yeah, I mean, one thing you can make is, if I can't make you like me, I can make you maybe dislike the person who's running against me. And that's, and I think that's our politics. And that may be easier to do right now in politics because, you know, it's, you know, the reason everybody goes negative and does opposition research is because it works a lot. I mean, it's like, you know, people may say, you know, I hate the stink of politics, but then they'll cite, you know, verse about, you know, what some candidate may or may not have done, which is a product of some opposition research and some push polls and negative ads and the like. So, it you know, it has an impact, and it's, you know, we've saw that in, oh gosh, go back to 1988 with the Bush and Dukakis ads, and, you know, every campaign has had that part of it, and some of it's clever, and sometimes it's just downright, you know, annoying, but gets the message across.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, the idea of not, and again, like let's say just to look at 2016, you know, there are a lot of people that I personally know who said that they didn't like either candidate, and so they just didn't vote. But if they were going to vote, they probably would have voted for Hillary Clinton.
That's right. So there was an effort to really undermine who she was. You know, look, the election was very close. And, when you talk about the kind of votes that separate winning and losing, you know, just as a sidebar, you know, I was looking at, someone pointed out the Electoral College to me, and you can take the Electoral College from 4 years ago, 2016, but all you have to do is flip Pennsylvania and Michigan, which are two states that President Trump carried, both of which could easily go, not easily, but could understandably go Democratic, and you end up with 269 each. So here we go again with another constitutional crisis. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but, you know, gosh, we've had everything else. Why don't we have now a tie in the Electoral College so that we can fight that one out?
Oh, wow. Well, hopefully that's not where we would be headed, but well, I guess no one knows.
Yeah, I'm sort of figuring we deserve better than that, but who knows?
Yeah.
It's tough. It's been tough. I know the journalists covering politics. It's become, as the news cycle has become a 24/7 undertaking, so has their life in terms of their work, and there's fewer of them, and they have to cover a lot more, and so it's become a heavier lift. And yeah, I've always respected journalists for what they do, and certainly this time has both tested them in terms of just the safety factor, but also just in terms of the workload. It's a difficult time.
Yeah. Well, last question is just looking back again at would the impeachment vote impact your vote? Yeah, there's a very real possibility that the impeachment, if it happened, might not actually have an impact, electoral impact. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it would have the impact, not necessarily directly, but it might have an impact in terms of, as we were talking about, the what else is not being discussed. So if some issues take a back seat to impeachment, and let's say healthcare isn't being discussed as much, or the Green New Deal and all these things, then it has an impact, but only because it stifles other discussion, because there's so much focused on the actual impeachment process. It may play out more in that than in, oh, I learned that Trump did this or Trump did that, in terms of the specifics of it. But stay tuned. I mean, this is, it's uncharted territory. So we think we've been around this, but Clinton's not a good example. Nixon's not a good example. And Donald Trump, if he ends up being impeached, I mean, that's something he's not going to look favorably upon. He doesn't seem to like rejection, and this would be an increase in his tweets, which happens every time something, the Mueller report's coming due, and he understandably, that gets him a little bit unglued.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for your time today, Lee Merenguff.
And people can check out your work
at maristpoll.marist.edu.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it. That's great.